Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth on 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and this is a revitalized version of Real Talk, a special, if you will. Rather than producing new half-hour shows every week, I've chosen to host occasional specials on topics of particular interest to me, and hopefully to you. I'm grateful to Voice of Vashon for allowing me this opportunity, and I hope you'll enjoy what we learn here together, dear listener. Today's Real Talk special is for listeners who have had no interaction with the criminal justice system in our state. We're going to learn about bail and how that system is interwoven in our criminal justice system to unfairly incarcerate low-income citizens of Washington State. Here to enlighten us are two staff members of the Northwest Community Bail Fund. They are Executive Director Cyril Walrond and Associate Director of Funds Recovery, Heidi Wally. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here today.
So glad to have you. Cyril, please tell us what the Northwest Community Bail Fund does and who is behind it.
Absolutely. Thank you. So just in short, the Northwest Community Bail Fund aims to end pretrial detention and ultimately abolish the cash bail system in Washington State. We envision a community that is healed, a community that is whole, ultimately in a world where every person's dignity is confirmed and defended. As an organization, what this means or what it looks like for us, particularly with our history, knowing that the organization was founded in 2016 as an organization, was inspired by a book club's reading of The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, very popular book. And with that, we truly and are committed to the fact that a community bail fund is by and for community. And so what we do, we have been able to work with community, be in relationship with community, and organize with community around resourcing this specific work so that we can do the things that we do as a way of posting bail, no strings attached for community members, so that they're able to defend themselves from a position of freedom.
Yeah, one of the things you said to me that really struck me not too long ago is that people are not free because they cannot afford to be free. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So understanding just that sentiment itself, people are not free because they can't afford to be free. The nature of bail, first, for context, bail is set by judges.
Oh,
right. I think that that's an important thing to note. So it's not an organization or individuals that are setting bail, but it's ultimately is set by the courts in the state of Washington. And if a person is accused and considered unsafe or unlikely to return to court for their on their own volition for their hearing, then the judge would say no bail. If the judge feels this person is safe or this person is fit to return, then the judge will set a bail amount for the individual. And what that typically looks like, it's an economic means in which the individual would then return back, kind of like a promissory note, so to speak. So saying like you provide this much money collateral, and that is held by the courts in order for you to return back to the courts to complete your hearings.
So before your trial.
Before your trial, while free trial.
So are those amounts of bail set according to, like, are there certain amounts for certain types of crime?
Yes, absolutely. Typically what you see is for higher violent crimes or crimes that are more serious or offenses that are deemed more serious, there will be a higher bail amount. For lesser crimes, particularly crimes of opportunity or crimes of economics, we see that there may be a very low bail amount for someone who was unhoused in community for simply trespassing. Right. Mm. Or living on the streets, which is now, you know, how we see in society the criminalization of poverty.
Yeah.
And which is truly what makes up the majority of our clients. And so, you know, with that, what we find is that these individuals are simply not in custody because they committed this serious or egregious offense, but simply because they cannot afford to get out.
So, boy, that's complicated. I know you explained it, but I'm not sure I understand. I guess the purpose of bail is to assure that a person charged with a crime is going to return for their trials. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Heidi, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, it's basically just to make sure that they come back to court and they finish the process and they go through their due process. And that's it.
So if I could add, to be clear, bail is not a punishment.
I think that's an important thing to clarify.
Absolutely. And I think that we often get that narrative mixed up with the reality of what bail is and also the understanding of the Eighth Amendment.
Right. What's the Eighth Amendment?
No excessive bail.
Oh.
Right. And so, you know, a bail is not to be set at an amount that's inaccessible for individuals, but it's to be set at an amount that is reasonable for the means in which they can actually post it.
So tell me, if I am an unhoused person and I am arrested for trespassing, what would be considered a reasonable amount for me to have to pay to get out of jail?
That's quite the conundrum, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Because it's not the price of 3 months' rent.
Yeah, right.
That the house person does not have, right? And so when we think about that, I think it's important to understand that you to quantify or qualify and put a monetary value on somebody's freedom. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Right. And so when we look at, you know, what is a fair bail amount, it's truly on our part as community, it's an impossible thing, because what I don't want to do is try to say, like, this is the number we feel is fair. And then now the courts say, okay, this is what is fair without considering the people who are directly impacted, because everybody's situation is different. Everybody's means and access to resources are different. And so what a judge should and ought to do is take into the full scope and consideration of those things, even if that means releasing individuals on their personal recognizance, which is a opportunity for individuals to be released without bail, without money, but saying, like, you know, we believe you will go through the process of returning without any monetary value associated with it.
Do you have any notion of what the percentage of cases that come up actually do not include bail?
Oh, that is a good question. I do not have that answer on hand.
Can you ballpark? Is it, like, unusual or...
In municipal court, where it's misdemeanors, we see it more often than we would in, like, superior or district court, where the offenses are higher or more severe. But we do see it a lot in municipal court.
Could you speak to the difference between municipal and superior courts for folks that don't really understand?
Municipal court is where there are misdemeanor charges, and in superior court, it's where they see or hear felony charges.
Ah, so superior court is for more serious crimes.
Correct.
Okay. So what happens to a person who is arrested and jailed, not yet charged, but unable to make bail?
Well, that person who is sitting there essentially just awaiting trial, there's so many different things that could happen. And again, everybody's situation and circumstances are different. What we know is that we have clients who we've been able to post bail for, and in the process of them waiting trial, understanding that they may lose housing, right?
Yeah.
We had clients who have been going through cancer treatment and, you know, have stage 4, stage 3 cancers and need to access their treatments, there's a serious urgency. And so what happens is, you know, you're not able to access that. You're not able to access the health care. You're not able to access, the legal resources to prepare a defense for yourself. So each day that you are incarcerated is a day that you're not preparing a defense. You're away from family, community, loved ones, resources. You potentially are losing housing or for a lot of our clients who are struggling with housing instability already, then it puts them in even more unstable circumstances. And also some of our clients are on the verge of getting housing for the first time in a very long time, and it sets them back. And so we begin to see a slippery slope of things related.
Well, and I would suspect there are people who also lose their jobs because they can't go to them. And it just seems like a spiral.
Yes.
That is antithetical to what we would hope is the purpose of bail or of incarcerating people to get them to trial.
Yes. Very much so. We think about just the perpetual harms of incarceration. Now, what I don't want to negate or minimize is that, you know, the alleged offenses folks are or could be incarcerated for, you know, may be offense of that caused harms in and of itself, whether harms to self or harms to other. So I'm not minimizing that. But what I do also know is that this is a system that also perpetuates harms on a large scale. And when we think about that, this is not a system of healing. This is not a system of wholeness. This is not a system valuing the humanity of individuals, but it's a system that is very dehumanizing by its core and nature, and therefore puts people in dehumanizing environments and circumstances that put them back and away from the resources they need to thrive, survive, and live.
This is probably an obvious answer, but who are the people who are most likely to be impacted in negative ways by this process?
I think everybody. but, you know, mostly BIPOC, marginalized, low income, no income folks. But it's harmful. It's harmful to everybody.
Has anyone ever done a study as to the impact on the cost of the system that jails people? I presume they're in county jails until they are arraigned or they get to court. Has anybody estimated the cost to the county of keeping people in jail, or is that an advantage of some sort?
Another question, great question. Like, I don't have the exact number for that, but what I will say is that when we think about the cost of incarceration, right?
Yeah.
First of all, how do you qualify or quantify the value of life, right? How do you qualify or quantify the value of freedom? Right. And so that's just, again, impossible. But now when we look at what it looks like on a scale of somebody being having a $1,000 bill and they're not able to meet that. And yet the cost of incarceration per day may be several hundreds of dollars.
Are they obligated to pay for that at all? Or are they obligated to pay for court costs? And that brings up to mind what I'm thinking of is legal financial obligations that are charged to people who are incarcerated over a period of time. Do people who are incarcerated awaiting trial have legal financial obligations added on to bail?
Yes, they do. So I think that understanding legal financial obligations, there's the part of it where individuals who are incarcerated, they not only have to pay for their, you know, bail, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they don't have the means to, but legal financial obligations also compound in interest with, you know, restitution and other things that are associated that very well and very often put people in a situation where they now not only are able to get out after the finality of their proceedings, but they also have a debt that where wages can be garnished and they may not be able to have the economic resources available to come from out of that. And you think about how these things add up, particularly when individuals initially were incarcerated for crimes of economics.
It begins to sound like a growing burden that is put on people who are already burdened by the fact that they are low income. When we talked off mic a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how the bail system is intertwined with the entire criminal legal system. Can one of you explain that, how it fits into the whole criminal legal system and the injustices that occur in that system?
Yes. So just kind of going back to the previous point you're saying, mm-hmm. One of the greatest costs associated with, you know, the incarceration or pretrial detention of community members is the cost to taxpayers.
Ah.
Right. And so we think about it. If our jails are being overfilled and overpopulated with individuals that very well do not pose a threat to society, but simply are there because they do not have the means to financial freedom and to get out of jail, then what that means is that now taxpayers are having to cover that bill. And so with the resources or the lack thereof, that same money that is going to house people in these inefficiently and ineffectively ran facilities, these warehouses, these cages in which people are being held captive, what that does is these are same resources that can go to education. These are same resources that go to things that could prevent incarceration. These are things that go to resources such as mental health and mental wellness, substance use and abuse treatments and facilities, so that we could actually contribute to the healing of our community rather than the caging of our community. And so when I think about how these systems play and are very much interconnected, looking at how, first of all, this is a very much a capitalistically driven system. Right. And so the financial aspects of this system, understanding that people are getting paid not to reduce or end crime, but really to perpetuate it, to maintain it, to keep the status quo going.
Who's getting paid?
Well, we think about where the tax funding goes. Right. And so, you know, there's budgets that are being allocated from cities and various jurisdictions and maintain the funding in these resources or in these areas with the lack of resources. And so, again, county jail buildings, right? Mm-hmm. Those are very large infrastructures, right, that are not efficiently and effectively ran. And so it's taxpayers who have to cover that. And then we think about, you know, the overcrowding or overpopulation of jails. Well, jails need corrections officers, right? And so because they need corrections officers, what ends up happening is now you're hiring, you know, all these folks, for many of which individuals could be released and back in community. Right. And so that's not the most effective use of positionality for employment. We begin to think about, you know, just the bail system. Right. And one of our issues with the bail system, which, you know, definitely we'll have this conversation, is that we are a bail fund, which is very different from a bail bondsman. Right. We'll talk about that.
OK,
right?
Good.
And so as a bail fund, what we do is we, again, raise money, no strings attached, to our clients. A bail bondsman receives money for collateral, as well as property and other possessions, for collateral at a 10% bond, which they work out with the courts. And so essentially they don't even have to transfer any funds as we do. They can take a piece of paper to the courts and say, well, on our good name as a business, we will bond this person out. Now, this person's family may have put their house up or a car up or other properties to cover the cost of that bail amount. And now if this person does not show back up to court, then they receive the bail bondsman receive those assets. Now, for us as an organization, again, we raise money, no strings attached. You know, we work with community, we collaborate with community, we raise funds with community so that we can post bail. And every single dollar that comes into our organization goes right into, before it goes anywhere else, goes right into us being able to post bail to make sure our community members are in a position to defend themselves from a position of freedom. Right. And so that shows a difference in how this capitalistically modeled, that is very much supported by these systems of bail bondsmen and bail agents, is contrary to the work that we do as a community bail fund that's truly valuing the humanity and centering our community.
So it sounds to me like the bail bondsman industry is an industry.
Absolutely.
In which those people who own the bail bonds companies are profiting. And it almost sounds like they're in collusion with the courts.
You said it, not me.
Yeah. So what kind of legislation or alternatives are you seeking to reduce the profit of bail bondsmen, to enhance the bail, the acquisition of bail for people who cannot afford to make it? Are you dealing with legislators? Are you working with county or state legislation? And what?
Yeah, absolutely.
What laws are you working on?
So there's a number of things there. And again, to be clear, we as an organization, we are made possible because of our allyship, our relationships, and our connections with community. You know, if it wasn't for community showing up and supporting and recognizing that, you know, this is unacceptable and what we can't do is do nothing. Mm. The fact that we show up each and every day. And again, just wanted to shout out our amazing volunteers, right? You know, we are an organization that has a large number of volunteers who show up regularly to support the work that we do. And if it wasn't for our volunteers who, you know, support us in posting bail, if it wasn't for our volunteers who, you know, are a part of the intake process, our fund recovery team, our advocacy team, our court watch, you know, for accountability with, you know, the courts to make sure that we're actually not only, you know, having accountability with the courts, but also monitoring and reporting on the different things that we find with inconsistencies of the courts. So I think I just want to, you know, acknowledge that. Like, I think that's a huge part of it. But, you know, in terms of our legislative agenda, you know, shout out to our director of advocacy who does amazing work. So, you know, our legislative agenda each year is out as an organization. And so, you know, we understand that there is no quick fix to these issues that we're facing. And so, you know, our perspective is that we build movements. We don't just build for the moment. We're working collectively and trying to figure out how we could affect various intersecting things. So while we recognize that the work towards cash bail and ending cash bail in Washington is an ongoing fight, I will say there is no current legislation there. One thing about the legislative process is that you don't just necessarily just create a bill and push it forward, right? Because there's not the support and infrastructure for that, let alone the people power of people being an informed critical mass to know that this is what we're pushing for. And so that's what we're working on. We are doing the organizing work, trying to inform and educate community, build allies so folks know why it is important to end cash bail in Washington State and the continued harms of having a capitalistically driven system that punishes poverty. And so with that said, again, we do have our legislative agenda, and we do prioritize things that are addressing or confronting our youth and youth incarceration. We have, you know, legislation that we're supporting around LFOs and
legal financial obligations.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. You know, there's been, you know, work around the clemency board and pardons board reform and different decarceration methods. You know, that's something that we believe, because while we are working on the front end, you know, to end cash bail and pretrial detention, we also know that it's not just on the front end that people are being harmed. And we want to be able to affect and a meaningful impact throughout the lifestyle or life cycle of this system.
Cyril, well, I think both of you once mentioned that that part and parcel of what the Northwest Community Bail Fund does is tied up with abolitionism. Can you explain how abolitionism is part of what you do?
Absolutely. First, I want to say that abolitionism often is misrepresented and misunderstood. You know, if we have a structure that we believe in large part is inherently flawed, inherently racist, and is not built for humanity, and arguably we could say that it was designed to do exactly what it's doing right now, right?
Say more about that.
Well, we look at just the history of the United States, and we look at the history of the United States being a history that was built for white, cisgender, property-owning men,
yes.
Right? Those are who are built and designed to thrive in this country, right? And so when you're outside of that categorization of the scope of that experience, this nation was not designed for you. Now, there's people who have privileged and benefited and by proxy to this elitist or this structure, but they themselves did not have the same power as those, you know, white cisgender patriarchy men, right? Or land owning men. And so there is that distinction. But in terms of looking at, you know, how this system capitalistically is designed and how it's built to do exactly what it's doing, the harm that it's creating and the harm that's being perpetuated, you know, from an abolitionist lens, you know, our value is that we are committed to not just undoing these harms, but we're committed to and maintaining the work of I would say building life-affirming institutions, building life-affirming systems, systems that honor the humanity of all people, systems that lift up and amplify the experience of people. So we say this, like, we work and believe in a world that is free from the confines and the asinine thinking, keeping people in cages that think that makes people safe, right? Like, just the thinking that I'm safe because someone's in a cage.
And the idea also, I think, that goes with the capitalistic view that you are looking at is the zero-sum game, which says if you, a person of color or of another gender, advance yourself somehow, I lose. How does that fit with the idea of abolition, that notion? How do you fight that notion? Heidi?
I just think about what somebody told me once was, it's a world of plenty. It really is. It's a world of plenty. And you getting what you need doesn't take away from me getting what I need.
And hopefully we can celebrate our distinctions rather than calling them differences.
That for sure.
We're almost at the end of our half hour. And we have a lot more to talk about, but I think our listeners would benefit by knowing how they can become part of the Northwest Community Bail Fund, how they can contribute, how they can be volunteers, and what exactly those volunteers might do.
Absolutely. I think that I want to say that the Northwest Community Bail Fund is by and for community. You know, this is a community space where we're organizing together, and we are working towards the complete abolition of the carceral system. Right?
That'd be nice.
Yeah, that would be very nice. And that's what we're striving for. That's what we're working for. But we know that that has to be done in collaboration as we fight for collective liberation. Right? We recognize that prisons and policing and surveillance do not create safety, but instead uphold racial and economic violence in our state and throughout this country. And so with that, we are committed to building a critical mass with community. Right. And so we, you know, always invite folks in community to volunteer with us, to engage with us, to show up and support us in various ways. You know, we have a number of different volunteer teams that are doing amazing work. We have, you know, story teams that are working on messaging, language, newsletters, and different ways of engagement. We have our funds recovery team, which definitely would love to talk more about our funds recovery process and that. But one of the critical ways in these times that we're currently living in, especially with the politics and the nature of things that are happening and the increased violence towards poverty, the criminalization of poverty, is to be able to support financially. You know, if folks have the means to give and the capacity to give and donate to this work, you know, that money, again, directly goes to our ability to post bail to and for our community members. Go ahead.
I'd like you to be able to tell our listeners exactly where they go to donate and volunteer. The other question I have is, Heidi, you're responsible for funds recovery. Can you explain the specifics of how that works?
Sure. So we post bail for folks, and once the case is over, the bail comes back, and we can use that to post bail for someone else. Not always does the bail come back automatically. There's a variety of reasons why that doesn't happen. And some are very complicated. And so it's my job to know what the bail laws are, to follow the bail, to know what happened to the bail, and to figure out how to get it back. And so I work a lot with attorneys. I work a lot with court staff. And I have a very vast knowledge of the bail system and of the bail laws in Washington.
It sounds like being a detective.
It is.
It's our very own detective.
Yes, it's right. A detective and a collection agency.
All rolled into one. Yes. So, Cyril, how do people contribute? Where do they go to contribute or to volunteer?
Absolutely. Well, you can visit our website. That is, I would argue, a great place to start. I'm not sure if folks will be able to access this link, but I can say for sure that, Northwest Community Bail Fund .org or NWCOM Bail Fund, BAILFUND.org is the place where, you know, folks can find our website, as well as other information on how to, if you're interested in volunteering and supporting that work, if you're also interested in donating, that would be the place to go. And again, you know, whatever folks are able to give and contribute to this work is of value to us. Our biggest thing is wanting to build community with each other, and that does not just solely mean financial or economic means, but being able to bring your fullest self to be a part of this work. You know, there are folks that have, you know, the privilege of more resources than others. But, you know, the lack of resource doesn't exclude anybody from being a part of our Northwest Community Bell Fund community. In fact, we aim to center those who are most marginalized, those who are most impacted, those who are most harmed by the system. But we understand that the work that we're doing, we need to include other and all of us collectively. Right. And so, you know, when someone has privilege or someone has experienced poverty, we want to make sure that they feel a part of this community so that we can build truly for collective liberation.
That's kind of a great close, but I wanted to ask each of you what you want people to walk away with. And Heidi, I see you've got something going.
Well, I just also wanted to add that you don't have to know a lot about this work to volunteer. Even if you're curious, just come join us, learn. Dive in deeper. Everyone's welcome. You don't have to have experience. You don't have to have a vast knowledge of the harms of the criminal legal system, but just come with an open mind and willing to learn.
That's pretty cool. What about you, Cyril? What do you want people to walk away with?
Absolutely. No pun intended for being on this island, this beautiful island of Vashon, but no one's an island unto themselves. You know, we need community. We need each other. And in order to build the future that we want, you know, to really build a transformative future together, we need each other. You know, we collectively as an organization often talk in our meetings with each other how none of us are free until we're all free. And we can't truly experience the liberation, the collective liberation that we strive for, that we hope for, that we have our vision set towards until we all are working together with that understanding. And I just want to leave with the quote, prisons do not disappear social problems. They disappear human beings. Homelessness, unemployment, drug addiction, mental illness, and illiteracy are only a few of the problems that disappear from public view when the human beings contending with them are relegated to cages. Angela Davis.
I could not have thought of a better close. Thank you, Cyril Walrond, Executive Director of the Northwest Community Bail Fund, and Heidi Wally, whose title is almost a job description.
Thank you.
Associate Director of Recovery Funds.
Funds Recovery. Yes.
Thank you both for being with us. I know I'm going to bring you back because there's a whole lot more to talk about. And thank you, listeners, for joining me here on this Real Talk special. I look forward to hearing from you. And stay tuned to the Voice of Vashon. You never know what might happen next.